listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, August 30th, and on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with John Clinch, whose latest book is Kings of the Earth. Born and raised in the remote heart of upstate New York, John Clinch has been an English teacher, a metal worker, a folk singer, an illustrator, a typeface designer, a house painter, a copywriter, and an advertising executive. Teaching and advertising took him south to the suburbs of Philadelphia for many years, and only with the publication of Finn, his first novel, was he able to move back north to the place he loves, this time the Green Mountains of Vermont. He is married to the novelist Wendy Clinch, and they have one daughter. I spoke to John last week, and we began by talking about Kings of the Earth, the crux of that story, and what inspired him to write it.
It really started for me in two places, one physical place, actually, and then two sort of intellectual places. The physical place, of course, is far upstate New York, which is where I was born, where I come from, where I grew up. I left upstate New York in 1976 when I graduated from college and moved to Philadelphia, or the Philadelphia environs anyway. And not long thereafter, in 1990, the tragedy of the Ward brothers became something that was very important in upstate New York, and it kind of bled out into the mainstream media to some measure, even around 1990 when it was going on. Was the story, as you I'm sure know, of four brothers, poverty stricken, probably, well, how can I put it? I was talking with a fellow who was a professor at Syracuse University not long ago at a reading up in Brandon. He said he had gotten to know the Ward brothers a little bit and was under the impression that if it were going on now, if they were growing up now, coming of age now, they'd probably would have been considered subjects for some kind of intervention in an institutional or county way. They weren't 100% right in their minds in some ways. To me, they represented a presence on the edge of civilization, if you can call certain parts of upstate New York where I live civilization, and I guess you can. at least it was the town. On the presence on the edge of the town of the country in its hardest kind of incarnation. These are four men, lived together, slept together, worked together their entire lives, knew each other and depended on one another. That was a very important thing. They depended on one another intimately. And one morning, one of them in their shared bed was dead. The police intervened, and ultimately one of the remaining brothers was tried for the murder of his brother and acquitted. So that kind of came and went. It was a story that appeared on whatever show Connie Chung was doing at the time, nationwide. Connie Chung actually showed up in Munnsville, New York, to interview the Ward brothers, and boy, oh boy, did they enjoy that. It was interesting because they were men like the brothers in my novel who live in a very isolated kind of way, but they still have a television. They're still aware of certain things about American culture in the present moment. One of the characters in Kings of the Earth says that these men go to bed at night watching television. They wake up in the morning and enter into an entirely different world from the one they've just seen. And one of those worlds must seem to them like a dream. It was that idea of the two worlds coexisting side by side that was so important to me. Mm-hmm. The other sort of emotional place that it comes from is my own family. The brothers in the Kings of the Earth are called the Proctor brothers. Mm-hmm. It's a good reason for that. My grandmother Clinch, her maiden name was Proctor. And I wanted to show that these guys, these characters, had a real claim on me. When I was a boy, we used to have to go out with my dad every summer to Schoharie County, New York, which is just to the west of Albany, which makes it sound a little more industrialized or built up than it actually is. It's sort of south of the Mohawk River, and it's deep farming country. It still is. We would go out there every summer to pick up my grandmother, who had spent the summer with her family. Her brothers had a farm in Schoharie County, and we, when I visited that farm, it was I was like Tom, the nephew in Kings of the Earth, visiting his uncle's farm. I found it bizarre and peculiar and frightening. I was a little boy from the town, and I'd never really set foot on a farm. My dad had grown up on one at various times in his life. Had farmed at any rate. So he was very much at home, and my grandmother's brothers were peculiar old men, very much the Ward brothers type in a lot of ways. I think there were, I have no idea how many there were, and they were mysterious and semi broken down and just inscrutable to me.
Were they not married? The same situation as the Proctor brothers?
No, actually they were. There were husbands and wives involved. I mean, I think she might have had three brothers and two sisters. So it was a pretty large family. However, my dad himself, and this is where I'm headed. He was born in that part of the world, but he grew up. At least some of his youth was spent on a farm outside Munnsville, New York, which is where the Ward brothers were.
Right.
He lived just down the road from the Ward brothers, although they were younger than he was. My dad is still with us. He's in his mid-80s. The Ward brothers died much younger, and he didn't even know them, but he was part of that environment. And my dad had five brothers. His own father died young. But not before he'd populated the world with six boys. And my dad grew up in the farming country outside Oneida, New York, in this family of rough and tumble boys. And a lot of the stories, in other words, this is where I'm headed, that happened to the Proctor brothers in Kings of the Earth don't belong to the Ward brothers. They belong to the Clinch brothers.
Yeah.
so it's my dad. It was my dad's family that experienced some of the horror stories, and not horror stories, but tough life stories that happened to these brothers.
Right, right.
Personal.
Did you draw on that for Lester at all, I'm wondering?
No, I didn't. Although my, as somebody says, I think it's Creed, says that he has an uncle who's his drinking uncle.
Uh-huh.
My dad always said that he was named after his uncle. My dad's name's Warren Clinch. He always said that he was named after his Uncle Warren, who was his drinking uncle. So he had a drinking uncle. But Lester is sort of my own construct. He's sort of another sort of atavistic appearance of a character like Finn, in fact, in this book.
Right, right. Well, now I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, you've got a wonderful cast of characters in this book, and as I was reading along, I felt that I was going to need to really pay attention because of the changing points of view, but in fact, it just flowed so beautifully, even though we were changing points of view from chapter to chapter, and I wondered...
Thank you.
Yeah, I wondered if you could talk about managing that as an author.
Yeah, it's that's an interesting question, and it's a very important question. Actually, when I turned the book in to my editor, Will Murphy, at Random House, one of his first responses to me was, "This should be so difficult." It should be difficult, but it's not. And it does demand a little bit of the reader. It demands that the reader be prepared for something that's not 100% linear. I'm always saying, my wife and I are always saying to each other that if there's a reader who says he has trouble understanding it after he's spent you know, 25 pages with it, then it's really more of a reading comprehension problem than than it is my problem.
Or maybe a stuck-in-his-ways problem. I think that it, in some ways it is linear because you organize it by what's happening in the book. And so what's happening in the book is presented from one person's perspective, and then another person might take over the story. You know, it's almost like what that exquisite corpse storytelling.
Yeah, it's one of those cases where I really wanted at the very end, well, I wanted to try to trot out everything that I knew about writing a novel, in the sense that I wanted this to be a book that if I never got another shot, I would be satisfied technically, that this really was my book. And then that meant doing a lot of difficult things. And on the other hand, the next level of that was I wanted to take all those things, wanted to take multiple narrators. There are at least 10, I don't know, something like 10 different first-person narrators. There are three very different third-person or near-omniscient narrators. Yeah. And there are all these different time frames. I wanted to do all that complicated stuff. I wanted to enter into the mind of a near mute and give him a voice, do all this kind of stuff, and then make it all invisible. That was really the idea, was to take all that stuff that Faulkner did and so on, but to make it disappear in the reader's mind. And the way that I worked toward doing that was exactly what you said. I really wanted to give the book the sense of people finishing each other's stories. Sort of like a conversation around the Thanksgiving dinner table or around the back porch, where the old folks get together and they tell the old stories and they remind each other of things. And sometimes the reminding isn't entirely logical,
right,
or chronological, but it's thematic.
Yeah.
So I started the whole thing very clinically. I mean, I did an outline that was many, 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 many pages long of what happened to every one of these dozen or so characters over a period of about 60 years. Started to plug into that time frame some of the old stories from my dad's life, the story with the cast iron stove with the rooster on it that gets branded into one of the boys' backsides. All that kind of stuff, and I'm try to figure out how to work those things in both thematically and chronologically. And then I started thinking about what kind of characters I wanted to have narrating and how I wanted them to roam through time or not. I mean, this all seems very, very clinical, and it kind of was, but it was sort of like building the framework for a house that you have to make sure is 100% square or else the cabinets won't fit.
Yeah.
So I built all that stuff, and then I let it go.
One of the characters whose narration was so interesting to me was D'Alton. Is that how you say his name?
D'Alton, yes.
D'Alton. And I mean, he's very much sort of self-serving salesman kind of guy, and his presentation is... His narration is always addressing other characters in the book who are sort of ostensibly absent from the chapter, but you can they can be taken as participants. It's really interesting. I was wondering how you developed that for D'Alton.
D'Alton, well, you know, I spent 30 years in advertising, and there's a sense to which, or a measure to which, D'Alton is every empty suit salesman. And you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
He's the guy who just talks and talks, and the stuff flows out of him, and nothing ever gets in. I once had a conversation, it's a great moment, with an old client of mine who described another guy we had just been meeting with as follows. He said he has two modes of communication, talking and waiting to talk. And that's sort of the all. He talks, and then he waits to talk, and he doesn't listen. He's funny because, as you say, he never... Unlike the other first-person narrators, who, especially people like Preston, who really try to explain things to the reader,
right.
D'Alton doesn't give a rat about the reader. He doesn't even know the reader's there.
Right, he doesn't seem at all aware that he's telling a story or participating.
we're just dropping down. The microphone is hanging over his conversations, and it's only picking him up. And I love him. I love that. I'm glad you started with him. People tend to want to start with Preston, which is great, but D'Alton is a really important character.
Well, I thought he was a very unusual narrative style, so I thought that was I enjoyed when I got to his first part. I was like, oh, that's cool, you know. And he stood out for it.
The golf, and he does stand up. That golf game that he's playing with,
right?
The guy, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Which, now, you know, that's a kind of a reference, of course, to. Boy, I shouldn't tell you these things. It's a reference to that great William Faulkner novel, The Sound of the Fury.
Which, oh, okay.
It begins with the golf game.
Okay.
And the idiot Benji is watching the golf game. And so we're sort of watching D'Alton's golf game, too. So,
yeah.
Hey, it's all there.
Now, there's a lot that's very interesting. Another thing that I found really interesting was Ruth, who's the mother of the Proctor boys. She's
the revered mother.
She's written in a third-person point of view, but in the present tense, which I found really interesting because, you know, the book starts out in a certain timeline and then we move around in time, but she's no longer living in the established primary timeline in the book. So to have her be written in the present
right.
tense was very... What, now, why did you do that, or do you talk about why?
that too is a good question. There are really three, as you know, there are three very different third-person narrators. One tied to Ruth. I like to kind of put it that way. It's not Ruth's voice, as you
right.
know, but it's connected to her, and it has to do with her world and her time period. One of them is tied to Donna, her daughter, and the last one in a row is tied to Donna's son, Tom. Mm-hmm. I wanted to experiment with the reader's perception of what we might call authorial distance or narrative distance. Mm-hmm. And Ruth's voice is a lot like the voice in Finn. In fact, I kind of copped some of it from the voice that I developed for Finn. It's kind of a big biblical sounding voice. Mm-hmm. And it's made immediate by the present tense, even though it's the most remote story that we have to tell in the book. Compared to that, Donna's voice gets more modern, mm-hmm. And it gets a little closer into the action. The characters aren't seen quite at so much of a remove. That's in the more conventional past tense. And then we get to Tom, and it's really modern. And quite close in, and very much tied to Tom and his brain. So that was really, in a sense, it was a way of establishing a distance. And oddly enough, that distance seemed to me to work better with the present tense because it set that voice apart.
Yeah, yeah. Another thing that I thought worked well with that, whether or not you intended it, was a lot of Ruth's life is about her tasks and her chores and just sort of taking her next breath and making it through the day. And I felt like the present tense established that she doesn't really have anything but what's going on right now. You know?
Yes, that's an excellent perception. It is. The present is present.
Yeah, it seemed to work well for her.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked a little bit about how you layered information, let all these different characters tell the story. And one particular scene that I just thought was so well done, just unbelievable, was Ruth is bathing the boys in the winter and there's ice on the floor. And then Audie takes over the narration and talks about the stove that has the Red Rooster logo on it or emblem on it.
Right.
And then Lester takes over and talks about his feelings about the boys, and you get a real sense of Lester, and you don't necessarily want to.
No.
And then you're back to Ruth again applying ointment, and you know that Audie's been hurt, or, you know, somebody's been hurt. And then Audie comes back and tells, you know, sort of the story about skidding into that rooster and being burned on his back. And so we have these five small chapters with various viewpoints telling this part of the story, letting us learn more and more with each section. And I just thought that was wonderful. And I wondered if that particular story maybe came from, you said something about your father and the Red Rooster. Did that come from some true story?
Yeah, that really was a true story. I've been of the opinion or of the understanding that it was my uncle who actually got this giant Red Rooster branded into his backside. I have learned subsequently that I may be misremembering that.
Yeah.
It was a neighborhood pal of theirs. But growing up in the conditions that my dad's family had. You know, as I said, his father had died young. His mother took in washing. You know, she was sort of in the present tense, like Ruth.
Right.
Did everything she could in order to raise up these six boys. And one of the things that happened was somebody, I thought it was my Uncle Olin, but I guess I might be wrong, was ended by this old red rooster on the side of the Franklin stove.
Yeah, I just felt that the way that came across seemed like something that you had thought about for a long time. I don't know.
Actually, I made up all the business about the baths.
The baths? Oh, wow, that was perfect, though.
Yeah, that I made up. You know, the drinking father who didn't care to come out, and then when he came out was angry about how the mother had flung the tin pail. And those things, that was all manufactured. The only real thing is that somebody, somewhere in the past, in my life, has a rooster branded into his backside.
Okay. maybe this would be a good time for you to read from Kings of the Earth.
Okay,
so this is John Clinch reading from Kings of the Earth, which is published by Random House.
The character speaking is Preston Hatch. He's the neighbor of the three brothers, and he's keeping an eye on their nephew, Tom, who's been growing marijuana on the property. And he says Tom was in the hayloft, and the rest of us were on the porch, and Vernon was saying how his throat hurt. He had a sack of whorehound drops that he sucked on when he wasn't chewing tobacco. He'd take them one right after another. I don't believe they helped even the slightest little bit. I think he knew that, but I guess he always hoped for the placebo effect. He had his left hand in his lap, and he was rolling up little pellets of stuffing from the chair with his right hand. They say Audie has a nervous problem, but it runs right through that whole family. There isn't one of them who could keep straight if you put him on the payroll for it. We knew when Tom came down because we heard his car doors open and shut. First one door, and then a little wait, and then the other. He was fooling with something in the car. Vernon said he hoped Tom would come around to the porch and pay his respects before he went home. After a few minutes, Tom did come around. He had a little plastic bag, and he put it on Vernon's lap, and Vernon gave him a look like it was trick-or-treat. I had a suspicion about that bag, but I didn't know for sure, not then. When Tom told his uncle he ought to be careful, since that right there was a good $15 worth, I knew. Vernon asked him could he chew it, because he didn't care much for smoking anymore, and Tom said that wasn't how most people used it. He didn't know if chewing it would work or not, but he couldn't say for sure, couldn't make any promises. Since that little bag was worth a good $15 of anybody's money, why take chances? Most folks either smoked it or made brownies. Vernon said he wasn't much good in the kitchen, so we thought he'd just stick with the regular way. Tom had some papers in his pocket, and he gave them to him, and he left. I'd heard that before about the brownies, but I'd always thought they were just pulling my leg. But it was true. Now, Vernon could sit on the porch and smoke his marijuana, big as life and twice as foolish. I was over there once or twice while he was at it. He said Tom had told him not to do it in the yard, but he figured the porch would be all right. A man's home is his castle, he said. What a man does in his own home is nobody's business. His brothers nodded their heads to that like a bunch of old sages, the three wise men. We sat out there one afternoon and one night. It was late, but there was a breeze still. Vernon wound up a little cigarette, and Creed put a chaw of Red Man at his cheek, and Audie asked for a little bit of that Red Man, too, rather than be left out. They were even going at it. Audie was whittling, too, even though it was too dark to see. His vision was going, anyway. They say a marijuana cigarette smells like rope, but I think it smells like a muskmelon. Kind of sweet and mossy, but with a little spike to it. It's a nice enough smell, if I'm allowed to say that. Not that I never think of taking it up myself. After a little while, I asked Vernon if he'd started seeing things yet, and he laughed at me. He said it wasn't like that. He said you don't see things. He kept on laughing like he had one over on old Preston Hatch, and I guess he did. He was the expert. He was a regular Timothy Leary in that crowd. It did seem to relax him some and make him talk a little more. He didn't suck on those whorehound drops when he was smoking, and maybe his throat didn't bother him so much. We sat there in the dark, and he started humming something. I couldn't believe my ears. I don't think I ever heard a note of music out of those boys, not so much as a whistle. I used to play a little tenor banjo myself, but in the Proctor house, music wasn't a useful thing to waste your time on. I heard Vernon kind of humming now, though, In spite of that catch he had way down in his throat, the catch in his throat made it buzz a little. What he was humming sounded like a lullaby, something I suppose he'd have learned from his mother. I guess he had to go that far back to come up with something. You use what you have. We all sat quiet. Audie stopped scraping his knife. There were headlights out on the main road, and the whirligigs turned in the little wind from across the pasture.
Thank you so much for reading that. I really enjoy that section. I love how Preston is such a caretaker for them, watches and makes sure everything's always going okay.
What I really like about that section is that it kind of demonstrates that there's, you know, humor here, and, yeah, but there's also a tenderness.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I love the observation that fidgeting could go down through, you know, the gene pool. It's very funny, yeah, that they can't sit still.
Yeah,
thank you for reading that. Now, the book takes place between the 1930s and the 1990s, but life on this particular farm feels throughout to me, it feels throughout like a story from an earlier era, you know. And I was just wondering, you know, as you were writing it, how did you keep yourself in that frame of mind? I mean, I assume now you're not living on a working farm or...
No, not hardly. For me, the real work of writing is in the details, and, you know, getting those physical, and I really mean physical details, getting those, that sense of a physical place, of people with physical weight moving in a physical space. That to me is the most important thing, because I've discovered that everything comes from it. I'm working on a new novel right now, and kind of rediscovering that again, and it's always a matter of really getting those details right, whether they're matters of how things feel or how things smell or how big things are and how they compare to individual human beings. Those are the places where A, readers either feel the story is true or feel the story is a cheat if you get it wrong. Mm-hmm. But there are also places where meaning comes from. And certainly in Kings of the Earth, the presence of these old men, ultimately old men, in this very demanding place, in this very demanding world, and their reaction to it is where the meaning of the book derives. Without that physical stuff, there wouldn't be the sense of caretaking and the sense of love and the sense of community that comes out of this book.
Mm-hmm. The details are quite something. And I don't have any experience with farm life, and I so felt that I understood what was going on, you know, and could see, you know, this world that you'd created.
You know, it's funny, I don't have a whole lot of experience with it either, but it's like people used to tell me when I was on the road, or they still do, about Finn, which, you know, is set along the Mississippi River between Illinois and Missouri in around 1830, 1840. They say, gee, how did you get the Mississippi so correct? And I say, well, you know, I knew the Erie Canal when I was growing up, but, you know, that's about it. It's a matter of the imagination, you know, and it's a matter of getting a few small details right, and, you know, just hammering at them until people believe you.
Yeah, although I imagine you have to do a certain amount of research to fill out a farm.
A little bit. I kind of counted on my dad to get things, you know, to tell me if there was anything anything out of line, and there were a couple of mistakes that readers have been. I think the first. One of the very first emails I got from a reader was the subject line was "mistake on page 148." So thank you.
P.S. I liked it. Well, that's funny. Well, let's see. Do you mind if I read a little something from the book?
Go ahead.
Okay. There's just a section in Ruth's point of view that I would just love to read something from her point of view. I really felt for Ruth. Ruth, a person cannot forever beat back the predations of time and the world. The house where she lives is the house where she raised up the children and the house from which she buried her husband. But it is not the same place. Her room in the back is a dank and airless cell. Her daughter, Donna, is gone, and with her such standards of cleanliness and order as a woman will maintain. She ascribes it to that. Now and then Audie will slip into her room and reposition the lace doily on the bedside table, or blow away a rime of dust that has gathered there along its edges, but that is the extent of it, the extent of anyone's intervention or upholding on her behalf. He means well, and she thanks him. When he is done, he vanishes through the door that he and his brother Vernon hung in the cut-hole so many years ago, when their father went on before them, and a barrier between their bedroom and that of their mother was required. It was as if they had been waiting all that time. I just wanted to read that because I love her sections, and I think it's interesting that you said that there's sort of a biblical sense to those sections, because I see that now.
I'm going to jump in after you. The last paragraph of that section is probably one of my favorite paragraphs in the whole book. Ruth has been taken to the hospital by her daughter Donna in order to have some blood drawn. She's dying of cancer. And the last paragraph reads, "The nurse pulls the needle and covers the red spot with a cotton ball and asks Ruth to keep it there, please," which the old woman does with a look of vast seriousness and intensity, holding her thin forearm as if it is the most precious thing on earth, cradling herself to herself there on a hard plastic bench the color of poison. The puckered vein, whispered just to cover it over, is a pale road map drawn on parchment, the road itself lost and gone, the map of no use to anyone, not even as a memento.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets to one of the things I was thinking about before, that, you know, just that moment, there's not much that happens there, but you know, it's a very simple moment of a woman holding a cotton ball on her arm.
Right.
But you know that motion that she makes of cradling herself to herself, and you know that observation that the it's a hard plastic bench, the color of what? The color of poison.
Yeah, and actually, following the idea that Audie's help is the extent of anyone's intervention or upholding on her behalf, and then at the end she's cradling herself. You know, it's what she can do for comfort. I do. Thank you for reading the end of that, because I do think that's just a wonderful ending to that section. You know, and it sort of shows her still still wanting to be on this earth. You know, I mean, she's had a hard life and she doesn't seem to be letting go quite yet either.
Yeah.
And the other thing about that section that it doesn't deal with it quite as explicitly as some other sections, but it does sort of get to the idea of cleanliness and of squalor and the squalor that the men live in, particularly after she and Donna are gone from the house. So did the Ward brothers story, I'm not as familiar with the news story, did that sort of come up in that news story that they lived in just absolute squalor?
Unbelievable. The story was made into a documentary, or covered by a documentary, called Brother's Keeper. And I recommend anybody listening to Netflix it. Isn't that a great new verb, Netflix?
Yeah.
Netflix Brother's Keeper. See, I live in the modern world. Netflix Brother's Keeper. It was made by a couple of Colgate graduates. You know, Munnsville, New York, is quite near Colgate. In fact, Hamilton, the town where Colgate is mentioned a couple of times in Kings, but it's a fascinating documentary. Robert Gulrich, who's become the biggest fan possible of Kings of the Earth, did observe, and he may be right, that the documentary about the Ward brothers is perhaps more condescending than compassionate. That was his phrase.
Uh-huh.
Because it is, you know, kind of interesting to look at these very peculiar men. There's a kind of a sideshow quality to it. But it does show the world in which these guys live. And that was something that I was really careful to avoid, to avoid that sideshow quality.
Yeah, well, and I mean, there's the truth of what you're trying to write, which is the conditions they live in. And so to present that truth is to present something fairly unattractive, something that is sort of repulsive, but on the other hand, it's the truth of what you're trying to present. So
yeah.
I didn't see it as a sideshow. I did enjoy, though, there is one point of view character, or not character, but one little snippet of narration from a cop named Burns.
Burns has one line.
Burns has one line in the whole book, and he says, frankly, I was just glad to get a little fresh air because he's been sitting in a room with Creed, and I just thought, oh, that's so funny.
Somebody had to say it. Now, the head of the state troopers outpost there, or whatever they call it, has been so kind, and so, you know, even though he doesn't necessarily engage in what seems like the kindest of behavior early in the book, but you know, he's so aware of being sensitive to these guys.
Right.
But it's kind of nice to have Burns just flat out say it.
Yeah. Now, as long as you've mentioned Dell, I know that in the newly released audiobook you have a speaking role and you do Dell's part. So I wanted to know, did you really have to audition, first of all?
I did. I auditioned to read Finn, but I didn't get the job.
Was that something you asked to do?
Yeah. It's pretty common these days, that, as I understand it, that people who do memoir get to read their own work, and I think that kind of makes sense.
Yes.
People who do nonfiction in general are more likely to get to read their own work. Most people who do fiction don't get the opportunity because, for good reasons or bad, there's a lot of acting involved. Voice acting,
right.
And my stuff is particularly difficult. I do a lot of dialogue without attribution, so if unless you're trying to sound a little bit like Audie and then a little bit like Ruth or whatever, it gets difficult for the listener to track. So this was a good opportunity because, of course, a lot of the characters, when they narrate in Kings of the Earth, don't deliver any actual dialogue themselves at all. They just report what was said rather than having stuff in quotation marks. So I did audition, and I auditioned for the part of Dell. I figured he was a middle-aged man of ordinary intelligence and good intent, and I figured I would fit that bill as well as anybody else.
Oh, that's great. How did you like participating in that?
It was great. I was the first one to read. I did the course because I had to go down from Vermont into New York and do it, and they hadn't finished casting everybody else, but it was a nice experience. I mean, it was Dell's parts took me a couple hours to get through, and he probably has about an hour and a half, or maybe an hour of airtime in the whole thing. And it was especially important for me. I had a kind of a secret agenda in wanting to read Dell, which is that Dell has the, you know, he has the secret. He's in the last pages of the book. He realizes, you know, what has happened, and he realizes what has become of these brothers, and what will become of them if he does what he's thought all along he has to do. Not giving too much away, I hope.
No.
He's the character who, if a novel is about a person who changes, he's the one who changes. Mm-hmm. So it was really important for me to be able to read Dell and get his last sequence right so that people would understand, listening to it, what he understands.
Now, I know that when they make these audiobooks, you'll hear who the director was or whatever. Is there a lot of direction, or was there for you?
Actually, it's there's a little bit of direction. One of the things you learn is that you have to stop in between sentences to let people soak in what you just said. Mm-hmm. So there's a certain amount of obeying the full stop, obeying the period. That's something. The only time that I really remember getting directed, I was listening to the audiobook a couple days ago, and I had kind of a real awkward take at the end of one section, and I remember being directed to do it that way, and I wish that I hadn't paid attention.
No.
I don't know. It's kind of funny. There are, you know, you have to make sure that you slow down when you come to the end of a section,
yeah,
so that people will expect it to end. So there's little stuff like that, but you know, it was my voice and my read and nice people down there. So yeah. Recorded, by the way.
Okay. It reminds me a little bit when Jaws, the movie Jaws, came out. Peter Benchley had a role in Jaws. He played the reporter on the beach. I thought that was pretty cool.
It's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to participate in your own thing.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that I remember when Finn came out, I remember being really kind of impressed by and proud of, was how many people were finding employment making this happen. So it's kind of nice to be part of that team in a way, not just, you know, not just the progenitor of the idea, but, you know, participating as you go along.
Yeah. Now, we've talked sort of tangentially about Finn. I wanted to just mention Finn. I know that it's about the father of Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, Pap Finn. And I have to admit, I haven't read the book yet, but I've read that you were warned ahead of time by well-meaning friends not to mess with Twain's legacy, and I wondered what your take is now on that.
Actually, my take on that, well, of course, at the time, my take on it was, oh, good, if people think I shouldn't do this, it's probably just the thing I ought to do. You know, because, you want to get some attention. And it did get attention. It didn't get the kind of, and I mean quality of, attention that I was expecting in some ways, because I, not to give too much away, it's out there everywhere. Anybody who's paid any attention at all to Finn or read a single review knows that the big secret of my book is that Huckleberry Finn's mother is revealed to be a black woman. Therefore, Huckleberry Finn, whom I always thought of as America's favorite white kid, is biracial. I had expected that there would be some trouble surrounding that. Happily, the first review from the Mark Twain aficionado and scholarly community was from a guy named Kent Rasmussen, who wrote, who's written great volumes of stuff on Twain. And he reviewed it for the Mark Twain Forum, and it was a total rave. And it ended saying that if you have a problem with a biracial Huck, you need to remember that there was nothing in Twain that forbids it, and Clinch makes a pretty strong case for it. And if it bothers you, you need to look inside your own heart.
Huh.
And I thought that was just exactly, you know, the response that I hope people would have. Actually, the Twain community has been really kind to me. The Mark Twain House and Museum down in Connecticut is one of my favorite places. I've done a few events there, and we raised a bunch of money for them. They were kind of on the verge of collapse a couple of years ago, and I got a bunch of my favorite writers together. Everybody from Tom Perrott, Arthur Phillips, to David Gates and Tasha Alexander, and we all went down and we did a big event and raised $500,000. And,
oh, wow.
Kind of prop them up a little bit for a while. So, Mark, I figured I owed it to him. You know?
Yeah.
I owed it to somebody.
Well, that's great. John, you have a website and you have a blog, which you keep updated pretty well, I see. And
well, I'm not much of a blogger, really. I'm sort of a blah, blah, blogger. But.
And you've had a very busy speaking schedule since this book came out, and I wondered how you find the marketing side of being an author. It sounds like you come from advertising and marketing background, so.
Yeah, I do, and I do my best to maintain my website at johnclinch.com. I don't blog very frequently. I don't have all that much to talk about. It's all sort of promotionally minded, really. You know, what's going on with the book. Some writers tend to want to do things like, you know, to get a famous published writer, but it's still mysterious to me, so I don't feel like I can give anybody lessons in that, and I don't know why anybody would listen to me. But there is a big promotional component. I mean, you really have to be prepared for it. I was fortunate with Finn that it was what's called lead title for Random House during its time on the when it was introduced, and that meant it got a ton of promotion. It got its very own website, beautifully done thing, and it got all kinds of stuff. But still, you know, for Kings, I went on probably a 8 or 9 city tour, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, there's a certain kind of demand that goes with that, and I've done some, you know, some stuff myself beyond the what I call the official tour. But yeah, you're kind of expected to go out there and be a public-y kind of person.
Yeah.
Some people are better at that than others. I'm actually happy doing the personal, you know, the personal appearance kind of thing. I put myself through college playing guitar in bars, and so it's just the same thing, except I have a book instead of a guitar, you know. So I just show up and try to make friends.
Well, I just have a couple more questions, John. First of all, I was wondering, what writers have influenced you? I have to assume Mark Twain is one of them, but you can speak to that.
Let me, you know, there are, it's a, My favorite writers are all over the place, some dead, some alive. I always like to begin answering this question by naming the author of what I think is the greatest, tenderest collection of short stories that you will ever find. His name is Alistair MacLeod, MacLeod. Mm-hmm. He's a Canadian. He's from Cape Breton. He's a very old man indeed right now, and he wrote two collections of short stories that were collected subsequently into one. And the book is called Island, I-S-L-A-N-D, and it is the most deeply felt kind of fiction that you will ever find. I hand out that recommendation like an inoculation. I mean, everybody should read Alistair MacLeod's Island. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful stories. Other than that, let me see. I'm, of course, influenced by and a great admirer of certain of our great dead American authors, William Faulkner, for example. Uh-huh. Faulkner's voice and methods are kind of really important to me. Herman Melville, a critic describing Finn, actually said, you may think that the careful reader might think that the secret heart of Finn is William Faulkner, but it turns out that it's actually haunted by the ghost of Herman Melville. And I thought, wow, that guy knows what he's doing. Because actually there was a whole section in Finn that was lifted from a Melville novel.
How?
He had a short novel called Benito Cereno about a guy who ends up he's a Spanish sailor, I think, as I remember, and he ends up on board this ship on which mysterious things are happening. It turns out that the captain of this ship is being attended to by a young black child, really, who in the end of the novel turns out to have been keeping an eye on him because the captain is no longer in charge and the ship has been taken over. It's a slave ship that's been taken over by its cargo. There's a section in Finn. By the way, that the ship was called the St. Dominic, as I remember. There's a section in Finn where Finn actually steals a woman who will be Huck's mother from a steamboat called the Santo Domingo, and she is actually a person who has a gun in her pocket and is keeping an eye on. Well, never mind, but we'll get to that. It's the whole kind of setup is taken from Melville. So Faulkner and Melville, of course, those are big ones for me. In terms of people who are around now, Alistair MacLeod I mentioned. I really adore a few people who are kind of underappreciated. Mark Halperin is a great favorite of mine. Uh-huh. And one of our best novels is, I think, Paul Theroux's The Mosquito Coast. Great, great, great book. Uh-huh. So I would definitely recommend those.
Okay. So my last question for you, John, is do you have any advice for writers who are working on a project and maybe get stuck or need a little inspiration to move forward?
My real advice for writers is pretty simple. It's, you know, that the old saw that says step one is to put your butt in the chair.
Yeah.
And I really, really believe it. Now, part of that comes from my having spent 30 years writing advertising, and that means you show up every day and you sit down and you have a meeting with somebody who you ultimately describe as D'Alton in your novel. You have a meeting with somebody and they give you input and then you go off and you do your writing. It's a matter of sitting down and getting the job done. That said, and even though I'm very professional and very reliable, I write probably 5 hours a day, and I get out, 1,500 words on a good day. I'm not a super, super prolific writer, but it's done when I'm done with it, you know. Mm-hmm. At any rate, quite often I'll get 10,000, 12,000 words into a novel and decide that it's horrible, that it's not coming to life, that the characters aren't getting up and walking around, that it doesn't mean anything to me, and I have to throw it away. I wrote a whole book in between Finn and Kings of the Earth that I actually turned into my editor, and then happily, he was on vacation in Europe, and by the time he got back, I had sent Will a note and said, don't bother to read it. But, you know, that was a year of my life.
Wow. Did he end up reading it and agree with you, or?
No, he didn't. He did what I asked.
Interesting.
Okay, don't bother.
He's probably got plenty to read.
Not gonna read it. And the reason was that I had begun just that day. I had sat down. My wife had – I'd come down the stairs to breakfast, and I had not been feeling good about this book. My wife didn't feel good about it. My daughter didn't feel good about it. And they're my two real touchstones. They're both really, really, really smart, good readers in different ways. And I come down the stairs to have breakfast, and my wife said, I have the idea for your next book. And I said, oh, really? And she said, yes, it's the Ward Brothers. And I thought, holy cow. And I began outlining things, and I also decided to start writing as I began outlining. And I sat down and I wrote Audie's first sentences, and I wrote Preston's first sentences. And that's when I sent a note to my editor and I said, never mind that other piece of junk. I have the real thing on its way. So,
wow.
So that said, you know, sometimes you have to write through the bad stuff. You know, you just have to get it out there and keep going, because you're not doing yourself any favors if you're not continuing to keep your tools sharp.
Okay. And your other piece of advice would be to call, we can all call your wife for ideas.
Yeah. Oh, she's great. She's the queen of ideas, I'll tell you. The new one was her idea, too. So I think I'm going to dedicate my next book to her, saying that she is, in the words of Bob Dylan, the brains behind Paw.
That's great. Well, John, thank you so much for talking with me today. This was really fun.
Thank you. It was fun.
If you didn't catch his name, that was a conversation with John Clinch, and his website is JONCLINCH.com, and his latest novel, Kings of the Earth, is published by Random House. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at AutismSupportDaily.com or 802-985-8773. I just have one item on the Bookworm's calendar for the week. The Milton Library is holding its book sale Friday, September 3rd from 12 to 6. And the Milton Library is at 117 East Road in Milton. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the interview you heard today with John Clinch. As we discussed, his novel, Kings of the Earth, proceeds in a somewhat non-linear fashion with various characters describing events as they experienced them. So, you know, consider your own work and think about how you might structure it differently if you wanted to. If the work is chronological, could you present it, I don't know, backwards or in a circular pattern? Could you present it by seasons or all in a single day? Play around with all kinds of ideas to see if an alternate structure appeals to you. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. I need to update that, but I will get there, I promise. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I do have a couple more announcements here. Let's see. Thursday, September 23rd, there will be a Harvest Moon Festival featuring a Harvest Moon barn dance. And that is part of the Radiator's work as a media sponsor of this year's Thursdays at the Intervale series. Each week, the Calkins Community Barn at Burlington's Intervale features music, activities for kids, and samplings of local products. And you can find out more information about the programs at intervale.org. Please remember that the station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.